One of the most interesting conversations I've ever had about food was with the Piraha during one of my stays in their village in the Amazon. I'd sent a note out to a friend of mine in a relatively nearby town and asked if he would do me the tremendous favor of sending some salad. Rice, beans, fish, and wild game smothered under copious amounts of Tabasco sauce can only keep one's culinary drive satisfied up to a point. When it arrived, I sat down to my first taste of lettuce, tomatoes, and cabbage in 6 months. Ahuapiti, one of my language teachers, walked up to watch me eat. He looked bemused. "Why are you eating leaves?" he asked. "I like these leaves," I replied. "I have not had any for many moons." My Piraha friend looked at me, then at the leaves, then back at me. "Pirahas don't eat leaves. This is why you don't speak our language well. We Pirahas speak our language well. We don't eat leaves." He walked away, apparently thinking he'd just given me the key to learning his language. But I found the correlation between lettuce eating and speaking Piraha unfathomable. What on earth did he mean? Eventually, I realized that Ahuapiti was telling me more than I had realized, that to speak their language is to live their culture. As an example of how poorly my culture has prepared me for some environments, I remember one time when I was traveling upriver, out of the village to Umaita. We chugged contently along in my small motorboat and came to my favorite park, the Encantro das Aguas. Here, the dark green water of the Marmelos meets the chocolate milk-colored water of the Madeira. The two colors run side by side for a bit, until finally the green water is absorbed. I saw a log floating in the fast current 200 yards or so away. It was twisted and about 40 feet long and 3 feet thick. I shifted to look at two macaws flying and squawking overhead. Then I looked back. It was closer to us now. Strange, I thought, the log is floating toward the bank, perpendicular to the current. Then, as it got closer, I saw that it was undulating. Suddenly, it came straight toward my end of the boat. This was no log. This was the largest anaconda I'd ever seen. Its head was larger than mine. Its body was much thicker than mine and over 30 feet long. It opened its mouth wide and swam toward us. I swerved sharply, throwing my family hard to one side. I managed to hit the snake with the propeller of my outboard motor. It disappeared. Then, a second later, the entire snake's body stood up out of the water, towering above the boat. We pressed forward at about 10 miles an hour. I looked at the entire length of the snake's whitish underbelly as it fell backward with a loud splash into the Madeira River. I didn't know anacondas could do that, I thought. That damn thing could have jumped in the boat with us. This had been a lesson about cognition and culture. My culture told me to look for logs when traveling by boat. It also gave me information on what floating logs look like on a river. But it didn't have anything to tell me about what very large anacondas look like swimming toward you. Theories affect our perceptions. They are part of the cultural information that constrains the way we see the world around us. There are many examples of such that don't involve science which illustrate this point. When my wife Karen was recovering from malaria, I couldn't be in the village, so I brought two Piraha men to Portobello, where she was being looked after in a clinic, in order to continue my study of their language. They only owned a single pair of gym shorts each and were self-conscious in the midst of city-dwelling Brazilians. They asked me if I could buy them shoes, long pants, and collared shirts so they could fit in at least a little bit better in town. So we walked up the main street shopping for clothes. The men asked me lots of questions. About the cars, they asked, "Who made those houses? They go fast." "The pavement. What is this hard black ground?" And about the Brazilians in general. "Where do they hunt their food?" And "Who makes the goods we are seeing?" We went into a store and found pants, shoes, and shirts for them. I thought that this was all going pretty well. No problem with bringing Pirahas to the city after all. True, I did find curious the Piraha's insistence on walking single file through town, just as they did through the jungle. I turned to Ipaogi and Ahuapisi and said, "Follow me. We're going to that store there," pointing toward a grocer's across the street. 3/4 of the way across, I looked back, and they were frozen in fear, looking at the cars that stood perpendicular to them on the road, waiting at the stoplight, revving their motors. I started back toward them, but the light changed. The cars started moving forward and honking vigorously at the 2 Piraha men. They were clearly on the verge of panicking and running through the traffic, unable to predict the movements of the cars, which are so different from any wild animals they've ever encountered. I got to them and took their hands. We made it to the sidewalk. "Those things scare us," they exclaimed, still not over their tension. "They scare me too," I agreed. "They are worse than jaguars," Ipaogi concluded. As I became more fluent in Piraha, I began to harbor a suspicion that my teachers were keeping their speech simple for my sake. When they spoke to me, the sentences were short and only used one verb each. So I decided that it would be worth listening more carefully to how they spoke to one another, rather than basing my conclusions on how they spoke to me. My best opportunity, I knew, would come from a woman called Maggie Pohai, who talked loudly and whom I could hear through the window of my bedroom. Over time, I confirmed that her sentences were structured identically to those spoken to me by my teachers, with just one verb each. But then one day, my friend Ko'oi was making a fishing arrow and needed a nail for the tip. He spoke to his son. "Hey, Paita, bring back nails. Dan bought those nails. They are the same." I heard this and it stopped me in my tracks. I realized that these 3 phrases were functioning together like a single sentence in English, but that their form was significantly different. In English, we would say, "Bring back the nails that Dan bought," and combine the sentences. But the Piraha didn't do this. They kept phrases separate. I realized that Piraha has no sentence like "Bill ran and Sue watched," or "Sue ran and ate." It lacks conjunction and disjunction, which is known as recursion. Linguists have long believed that recursion is very important in language. So I knew that any evidence that Piraha could bring to bear on the issue would be important. I published some of my findings, and the Piraha's language and culture began to attract attention. There is currently no role attributed to or even allowed for culture in shaping the grammar in most linguistic theories. This is why it's important to study languages like Piraha, in which culture does appear to shape grammar. For example, one day it dawned on me that the Pirahas do not have any system for counting and numbers. I'd thought that they had numbers 1 and 2 and many, which is a common enough system around the world. But when the Pirahas asked me when the plane which brought supplies was coming again, I held up 2 fingers and said, "Oi, days," using what I thought was their term for 2. They looked puzzled. As I observed more carefully, I saw that they never used their fingers to count or tally with. And I also noticed that they could use what I thought meant 2 for a couple of small fish, or for 1 relatively larger fish. So their term was being used to indicate volume. The Pirahas, I concluded, have no numbers in their language, and do not use counting in any form at all. I'd argue that culture and language are intertwined for every society in multiple ways. The effects of grammar on culture are varied. Sometimes they can be as obvious as your right hand, as I discovered on one of the innumerable days I spent working with my friend Ko'oi. Okay, this hand is the one that Americans call the left hand. What do the Pirahas call it? Hand. Yes, I know it's a hand, but how do you say left hand? Your hand. No, look. Here is your left hand. Here is your right hand. Here is my left hand. Here is my right hand. How do you say that? This is my hand. That is your hand. This is my other hand. That is your other hand. This was really trying, but at least Ko'oi agreed to work with me more on it. So I went through my routine again. Left hand? The hand is upriver, he answered. What on earth is going on, I thought, completely frustrated. So now he's making fun of me? I pointed to his right hand. The hand is downriver. I give up, I decided. I moved on to something else. But for days, I felt utterly incompetent as a linguist. A week later, I went hunting with a group of men. We came to a fork in the path about 2 miles from the village. One of them yelled from near the back of our line, "Hey, Ko'oi, go upriver!" Ko'oi turned right. As we walked further, our orientation changed. Another person spoke to Ko'oi, still in the lead. "Turn upriver!" This time he turned left, not right, in response to the same command. During the rest of our hunt, I noticed that directions were given either in terms of the river or the jungle. The Pirahas knew where the river was. I couldn't tell. I was thoroughly disoriented. They all seemed to orient themselves to their geography rather than to their bodies, as we do when we use left hand and right hand for directions. I didn't understand this, and I have never found the words for left hand and right hand. One of the most common comments I hear from visitors to the Pirahas is that they seem to be talking and laughing together constantly. As they lie around the ever-burning fires of their huts, they bury potatoes or tubers in the coals to roast slowly. They talk about fishing, spirits, the last visit by a foreigner, why the Brazil nut trees yielded fewer nuts this year, and so on. Pirahas pause to pull up a hot potato, open it, and ruminate almost literally as the conversation progresses. I have never heard a Piraha say he or she is worried. In fact, so far as I can tell, they have no word for worry in their language. They have built their culture around what is useful to their survival. They don't worry about what they don't know, nor do they think they can or do know it all. The Pirahas way of life has been extremely persuasive. It has made me look at how I live my own life, to question my beliefs and even my religion.